on 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Tune in for the best local programming.
Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan. This is Democracy Now!
Because I am trying to enhance my voice to talk about our people, our communities, and why climate change is needed to be treated urgently. We need the money. We need it now.
We are protesting here because we have discovered that there's more fossil fuel lobbyists attending the COP29, which means the voices of the voiceless will still be suppressed.
I'm here with the Palestinian delegation, and one of the issues that we're discussing is global energy embargo.
Despite the pledge from countries at last year's climate summit in Dubai, emissions from the burning of coal, oil, and gas continue to rise in 2024, now set to be the hottest year on record. We'll hear the voices of protest and speak with Asad Rehman of War on Want about the state of the climate talks. Then to the state of human rights here in Azerbaijan, where a number of journalists, human rights and climate activists have been arrested in the lead up to the COP. And finally, President-elect Trump has promised to pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement again while filling out his cabinet. He's nominated oil and gas industry executive Chris Wright to serve as energy secretary. Wright's a fracking magnate, a climate denier, and a champion of fossil fuels.
There is no climate crisis, and we're not in the midst of an energy transition either. Humans and all complex life on Earth is simply impossible without carbon dioxide. Hence the term carbon pollution is outrageous.
Wright drank a fracking fluid with beach bleach cocktail to prove it's safe. We'll speak with the president of the NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council, about his nomination. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a major change of U.S. policy, President Biden's given Ukraine the green light to begin striking inside Russia with U.S.-supplied long-range missiles. The decision comes just 2 months before Donald Trump takes office and his North Korean troops have begun supporting Russia on the battlefield. The New York Times reports Biden's own aides were divided on the decision, with some fearing this could lead to Russia retaliating against the U.S. Earlier today, the Kremlin accused the Biden administration of adding, quote, oil to the fire. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky spoke Sunday.
Today, there's lots of talk in the media about us receiving permission for respective actions. But strikes are not carried out with words. Such things are not announced. Missiles will speak for themselves. They certainly will. Glory to Ukraine.
Over the weekend, Russia launched a massive missile and drone attack on Ukraine's power grid, resulting in major blackouts. The city of Sumy, a Russian missile, hit a residential building, killing 11 people, including two children. Pope Francis has called for an investigation to determine if Israel's war on Gaza constitutes genocide. This comes as the official death toll in Gaza nears 44,000, but that's believed to be a vast undercount. On Sunday, an Israeli airstrike on a residential tower in Beit Lahia killed as many as 72 people. On Saturday, Israel struck a school in Gaza City's Shati refugee camp, housing displaced people. At least 10 Palestinians were killed. Another 10 were killed in a strike on the Berej refugee camp. This is Eid Abu Rikab, who lost cousins in the attack.
It's one of the biggest crimes, something that doesn't happen anywhere else in the world. Why target peaceful people sitting in their home? What could they possibly have to justify hitting them in their own house? If you want to target military personnel, go and search for them. The one who dies is always the civilian. We were forced to flee from the north and went to Al-Mawasi, which they said was a safe place. Then you come and strike there.
Israel is continuing to bombard Lebanon despite talk of a possible ceasefire. Al Jazeera reports 8 more paramedics have been killed in Lebanon. On Friday, Lebanon's caretaker prime minister urged Iran to persuade Hezbollah to agree to a ceasefire deal with Israel. Meanwhile, Israel's assassinated Hezbollah's media chief, Mohammed Afif. He was killed in an airstrike in central Beirut. Afif was one of the last remaining public faces of Hezbollah. In Israel, 3 protesters have been detained after flares were fired near the home of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The incident occurred as protests continue calling for a ceasefire deal to free the remaining hostages in Gaza. On Capitol Hill, House Republicans are attempting to once again ram through H.R. 9495, a bill that would allow Trump and future presidents to effectively shut down nonprofits by labeling them a terrorist-supporting organization. The measure could target humanitarian aid groups, news outlets, schools, and countless civil society organizations. Congress failed to fast-track the bill last week, falling short of a required 2/3 of majority, despite dozens of Democrats voting in favor along with Republicans. But the next vote, which could happen this week, would likely only require a simple majority. A coalition of groups said in a statement, quote, "This bill was designed to criminalize organizations and activists who oppose the U.S.'s unconditional support of Israel's genocide of Palestinians and the slaughter of Lebanese civilians," unquote. Signatories to the statement include CARE, that's the Council on American-Islamic Relations, and American Muslims for Palestine. Oxfam criticized the bill, saying Trump could use it to silence and censor critics, curb free speech, and target political opponents. Donald Trump has picked fracking executive Chris Wright to be energy secretary. Wright is CEO of Liberty Energy and serves on the board of Oklo, a nuclear power startup. Wright's a vocal supporter of oil and gas development, who has denied climate change is a crisis.
There is no climate crisis, and we're not in the midst of an energy transition either. Humans and all complex life on Earth is simply impossible without carbon dioxide. Hence, the term carbon pollution is outrageous.
We'll have more on Chris Wright's nomination later in the broadcast. We'll speak with the president of the NRDC. More details have emerged about a sexual assault allegation against Pete Hegseth, the Fox News weekend host picked by Donald Trump to become defense secretary. Hegseth has been accused of assaulting a woman in a hotel room in 2017 after he addressed the California Federation of Republican Women. Hegseth's lawyer has claimed the encounter was consensual, but the Washington Post reports Hegseth paid the woman an undisclosed amount after she signed a non-disclosure agreement. In other transition news, Trump has picked Federal Communications Commissioner Brendan Carr to chair the agency. Carr wrote the Project 2025 chapter on the FCC for the Heritage Foundation. He's a critic of big tech, who is expected to roll back many Biden-era policies, including net neutrality protections. Carr served on the FCC since 2017. In the Philippines, a landslide caused by Super Typhoon Manny killed at least 7 people and destroyed dozens of houses in Nueva Vizcaya province, as the northern Philippines suffered its 6th major storm in under a month.
The floodwater from that typhoon in the surrounding provinces gushed here because the elevation of the land here is lower. It makes our lives difficult. It's hard for us, especially for those of us without sufficient food. It's dreadful.
Southeast Asia is one of the world's most vulnerable regions to the worsening climate crisis, as rising ocean temperatures lead to more frequent and destructive storms. The UN climate summit here in Baku, Azerbaijan, has entered its second and final week. On Saturday, activists held a silent protest to demand the phase-out of fossil fuels, climate financing for the global south, and a just transition to clean energy. Earlier today, activists called for an end to Israel's war on Gaza. This is Mohammed Kamal from the Egyptian group Greenish.
When we're calling for an energy embargo, we're calling it because it's the primary source that is fueling this genocide. We need action and not commitment. Words are empty. We need this action to be in front of us. People in the region have been speaking out, but governments are not matching that action at all. So we need to see these commitments happening. We need an energy embargo.
President Biden and other world leaders are gathering in Brazil for the G20 summit. Ahead of the meeting, Biden became the first sitting U.S. president to visit the Amazon rainforest. On Saturday, indigenous protesters in Rio de Janeiro took giant cutouts of Biden and other world leaders and sank them in the water to demand more action on the climate crisis. This is Kleber Carapuna of the Articulation of Indigenous Peoples of Brazil.
In anticipation of the meeting of the big global leaders of the G20, we are sinking these heads to represent how these leaders, who head some of the biggest economies in the world, are failing to face climate change.
In a separate protest, activists in Brazil placed 733 plates on Copacabana Beach to represent the 733 million people suffering from hunger in the world. Antonio Carlos Costa is a founder of the group Rio de Paz.
We placed 733 empty plates on the sand of Copacabana Beach, symbolizing the 733 million human beings who went hungry last year, according to data provided by the United Nations. The aim of this public act is to demand that the public authorities attending G20 here in Rio de Janeiro make a swift commitment to eradicating hunger.
Palestinian rights protesters also marched in Rio on Saturday to call for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and Lebanon ahead of the G20 summit. A Guatemalan appeals court has overturned the order that released journalist Jose Rubén Zamora from prison to house arrest last month and ordered him to return to jail. The National Press Club blasted the decision in what they called the, quote, baseless and vindictive case brought by the Guatemalan government, unquote. Zamora is the founder of El Periódico, which was shut down by the previous president, Alejandro Giammattei. In Las Vegas, a man was shot dead by a police officer in his own home after he called 911 to report a break-in. Brandon Durham, a 43-year-old black father and realtor, was with his 15-year-old daughter at the time, who survived the shooting. Durham's partner spoke out against the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police following the deadly shooting, saying, quote, "What are you looking at? Not the colors of the clothes. You're looking at the color of the skin, and that's why he's dead," unquote. The U.S. Justice Department has launched a civil rights investigation into the killing of Sonia Massey in her kitchen by a sheriff's deputy in July. Massey, a 36-year-old black woman, had called 911 for help after suspecting a possible intruder was outside her home. The Sangamon County deputy, Sean Grayson, who's white, has been charged with first-degree murder. And the family of Malcolm X has filed a $100 million federal lawsuit against the New York Police Department, CIA, and FBI, claiming the agencies engaged in a, quote, fraudulent concealment and cover-up, unquote, of Malcolm X's assassination in 1965. Civil rights attorney Ben Crump is representing the family.
The government fingerprints are all over the assassination of Malcolm X.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting live from the United Nations Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan, which has entered its second and final week. Despite the pledge from countries around the world at last year's COP28 in Dubai, The burning of coal, oil, and gas continued to rise this year. 2024 is also set to follow 2023 as the hottest year on record, this according to the World Meteorological Organization. This year's climate summit comes amidst high uncertainty for the future of climate negotiations, as U.S. President-elect Donald Trump has promised to pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement again. Despite strict regulations, protests have been taking place here at the COP as climate activists from around the world try to get their voices heard. In fact, a number of journalists and climate activists in Azerbaijan have been arrested in the last year in the lead up to COP. We'll be talking about that later in the broadcast with Human Rights Watch. But first, on Saturday, Democracy Now! Was here when hundreds of climate justice activists from around the world occupied a plenary room to protest the lack of progress on climate negotiations and then came out for a silent protest in the corridor where Democracy Now! Caught up with them.
Hi, my name is Sydney Males Muenala. I'm from Ecuador. I am an indigenous woman from the community Quichua Otavalo. So we are here because we need to reclaim all of the violation of the human rights, especially from the indigenous people. So we are here like young people, young indigenous women, because we need to defend our territories and demand the mining, the climate crisis, because you have the transnationally in our territory, and this is like the violence for our bodies, our community, our territory, our water.
My name is Juliana Esprilla. I'm from Colombia and an Afro-descendant woman, and I'm here because I am trying to enhance my voice to talk about our people, our communities, and why climate change is needed to be treated urgently. We need the money. We need it now.
My name's Karina Lester. I'm from Australia, and I'm a second-generation survivor of British nuclear tests that happened in Australia in 1953, but the program continued through the 60s as well. So I've come here to be part of this event to just send a strong message around nuclear and the impacts it's having on Indigenous peoples in Australia and also around the globe as well. So here to, you know, voice our concerns, because our government's also thinking of nuclear power plants as well. So we're very concerned about that as Indigenous peoples, because it'll impact on First Nations peoples in Australia.
Would you share some of the impact it had?
Yeah, many people had passed, but many people have quite sick illnesses as well from the British nuclear testing program that happened in the 50s and 60s. My father was blinded by those British nuclear tests that happened on the 15th of October 1953, and so it took something away from him. And we as the next generation live with this and carried that tragic story of what happened to his people, how his people were harmed by the fallout, and how people still continue to suffer today with autoimmune diseases, with chest infections, with skin rashes on their skin. There's many other, like, infant mortality concerns within our communities as well, and we're very remote in Australia, and those locations were very remote, and so we're quite concerned about our people, but also our environment, because our country wears the scars of those British nuclear tests today.
Chabo Sibego from EarthLife Africa in South Africa. So we are here for a protest. Number one is to raise awareness to the whole global society that more fossil fuel must be kicked out of Africa. More finance should be allocated for sustainable projects. Finance must actually be allocated to all the African regions that has been, their environment has been destroyed as a result of fossil fuel extractivist projects. We are protesting here because we have discovered that there's more fossil fuel lobbyists attending the COP29, which means the voices of the voiceless will still be suppressed. So, therefore, we felt that it is proper for us to combine and join forces to protest, you know, to do a silent protest and also a peaceful protest to raise our awareness, to amplify our voices.
My
My name is Nadia Haddad. I'm from the European Disability Forum. And the purpose of us being here is to reclaim the rights of persons with disabilities, because mostly we have 1.9 billion of persons with disabilities around the world, and the majority of them is living in the south. That's mean one on every six persons has a disability, and yet we are not recognized. We are not part of the consultancy of persons with disabilities. We are not there when they're taking decisions. So we are those who are really left behind between the most vulnerable worlds, while we are the most impacted. For example, whenever there is a disaster, first people are only starting with information. The information given is not accessible. For example, deaf people, people are blind, people are deafblind, people with intellectual disability. So they even don't get the information. There's an alarm. They don't hear it. When there is something, an emission, a special request, people who doesn't understand easily, or people with social psychological problems do not know where it is. So we are reclaiming, for example, a fast tracking mechanism, so they could detect them very fast. When there is rescue, for example, there were floods in Germany. We are not speaking about the south. There were floods in Germany. Those who stayed behind were all of them are wheelchair users. 10 of them just kept drinking in the water, because when the firemen arrived to rescue them, they didn't have adequate materials to rescue them. So whenever something happens, persons with disability are always the most affected. They can't run away, they can't understand, they can't hear, and they are not considered be rescued first, because priority takes too much time. So there is a kind of triage, even in disasters. And that's why we are here. We want equality, we want them beforehand to prepare. And if something happens, then to be sure that if we're going to build better, build back better, then it should be accessible and affordable for all of us.
I'm Carolina Santos, I'm from Brazil. I'm an activist, I'm climate and environmental social activist in Brazil.
Brazil's hosting the next COP.
Yes, in my city, Belém. So we're kind of doing some preparations for that here. The main theme this year is climate financing. So we find it really important that especially people from the countries of the Global South are present and have a voice. Unfortunately, we weren't able to say anything by the regulations and stuff, but we are trying to make noise as well as we can, trying to get our message across as well as we can. So we're here to demand justice for the Global South. We're here to demand climate financing for adaptation and mitigation for the climate for the Global South, especially the countries that suffer the most with massive climate events.
My name is Akram, and I'm here with the Palestinian delegation. And one of the issues that we're discussing is global energy embargo. So there was an action demonstration here in this quite large hall in Baku. I think we're actually under a football stadium. The action was cross-constituency action to raise awareness about the anger that many people feel at the fact that these COP negotiations are increasingly disconnected from reality. And the issue that we were raising alongside many others was this question of the fueling of genocide. The same fossil fuel companies that profit from the destruction of the environment are also profiting from the genocide being committed against the people of Palestine, particularly the people in Gaza. For example, the jet fuel used in US aircraft is shipped from the United States. Fuel is shipped from here, from Azerbaijan, through the BTC pipeline, through Turkey, and then shipped to Israel. All of this is part and parcel of the Israeli war machine. And we've now had a year of seeing the most horrifying scenes on our television screens. No one in the world is in any doubt that what we're witnessing is a genocide. It took very many months for world leaders to say that they were willing to accept a ceasefire. And now this language of calling for a ceasefire has become totally and utterly meaningless. What we want is not empty words, it's action. And we particularly expect that from the nations in the world that claim to support the people of Palestine. Amongst the foremost groups, amongst the foremost nations sending energy to Israel are South Africa, who initiated the ICJ case, Turkey, which speaks regularly for the people of Palestine and yet allows 50% of Israel's oil to flow through its territory, and Brazil, where 9% of Israel's oil comes from. What we're saying is that we need to follow the example of Colombia, who took the decision in August to stop selling coal to Israel because the Genocide Convention obliges them not to sell any weapons or dual-use products, products that can be used in the conduct of war, which will aid and abet the committing of a genocide. Colombia took that decision relatively quickly, relatively straightforwardly, and there's no reason why other nations cannot make that same decision. It's not enough to pretend to support the people of Palestine, to make grand claims. Now, a year on into this genocide, people are judged by their actions, not their words. And any of these countries could take and follow the example of Colombia in imposing an energy embargo, and that would have an enormous impact directly on the ability of Israel to conduct the genocide, but long-term on its ability to continue its settler colonial expansionist project.
Voices of protesters Saturday here at the United Nations Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan. Special thanks to Democracy Now!'s Renee Feltz and Tamari Astudio. In a minute, we'll speak with one of those voices. He'll join us in person, Asad Raymond of War on Want, about the state of the climate talks. And we'll get an update on the state of human rights here in Azerbaijan. We'll be joined, here in Baku, a number of journalists, human rights, and climate activists have been arrested in the lead-up to the COP. Stay with us. Playing the hand pan in the old city here in Baku, Azerbaijan. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting live from the United Nations Climate Summit here in Baku, Azerbaijan, which has entered its second and final week. There's already frustration over a lack of progress on the key issue of financing the energy transition and climate adaptation in global South countries. This comes after last year's climate summit, COP28 in Dubai, where world leaders agreed to transition away from fossil fuels after past summits just called for restrictions. We just heard voices of protest. Now we're joined by one of those people, Asad Raymond. He's executive director of War on Want and lead spokesperson for the Climate Justice Coalition. Well, another COP, another interview with you, Asad. Yes. We're here in Azerbaijan, a leading petro-state in the world, following last year's COP summit in another petro-state in the United Arab Emirates. Can you talk about, for people who aren't familiar with these UN gatherings, the significance of this, what you expect to come out of it, and what you're seeing actually happen through this last week?
Well, Amy, the last time we spoke, I think it was in Dubai, the bombs were dropping on Gaza. We as civil society were standing in solidarity with our colleagues who were dying in Gaza and saying we must stand up for human rights. And a year later, of course, we have now the International Criminal Court, the International Court of Justice, countless human rights reports all talking about war crimes, crimes against humanity, a genocide taking place, in Gaza, and of course all with impunity and active complicity of some of the most powerful countries in the world, the United States, United Kingdom and the European Union, and the very rules of war, rules of the international rule system, multilateralism, is being burnt to the ground. So we came in here with a very heavy heart. Our colleagues are still being killed. We've seen food being used as a weapon of war. The importance of human rights propelled us to, of course, use this moment to raise our voice and still call for a ceasefire and, of course, call for end complicity. But the negotiations themselves, it's often been called the finance COP. And the reason why it's called the finance COP is this COP is meant to agree what the next quantum, and which is the collective goal of money that is meant to be provided from the global north to the global south because of the responsibility of the global north for causing this crisis, and what that figure will be, what the quality of that money will be. Will it be in public finance, or will it be in debt creating loans? Will it be in private finance? All of these things are being fought out over here in week one and in week two.
So I want to ask why you're here and why so many thousands of people have come to this climate summit. Prominent climate activist Greta Thunberg announced last week she's not attending this COP summit over Azerbaijan's climate and human rights record. She spoke Friday in Yerevan, Armenia.
I think we have to stop pretending that conferences like the COP that currently are not leading to any even close to meaningful climate action that we need. For example, last year we saw an all-time high of greenhouse gas emissions, and 2024 is said to be the hottest year ever recorded. These COP processes are failing us. Having these conferences as greenwash platforms for politicians to pretend that they are taking action, of course, it's also greenwashing the human rights abuses that these countries are committing. So it's both greenwashing and greenwashing the climate action and greenwashing their ethnic cleansing.
So that's Greta Thunberg, the well-known Swedish climate and human rights activist. Asad Rehman, you made a different decision.
Yes, because I see these spaces as fundamentally being about a question about power. We know that the rich and powerful have got way more power than ordinary people, and this is a contested space. And we have to build our power, make sure our politicians act in our interests, in the interests of the planet, and not of the rich and the elite and big business. And that's true at national level, is it, in a global level. But it is important that we're here, because we're the ears, eyes and voice of those on the front lines. Many people come here with the hard evidence to try and influence these negotiations, and knowing the imbalance of power that exists between the richest nations and developing countries, if we as civil society weren't here also holding the feet of global north governments to the fire, we would see much worse outcomes than we're seeing already.
So I wanted to play another clip. This is of Azerbaijan's Minister of Ecology and Natural Resources, Mukhtar Babayev, is COP29's president. Previously spent 26 years at the state oil company of the Azerbaijan Republic, known as SOCAR. Ahead of the summit, the group Global Witness released covert recordings of Azerbaijan's COP29 chief executive, Elnur Sultanov, promoting possible fossil fuel deals with someone, well, posing as an investor. The fake investor told Sultanov they were considering sponsoring COP29 in exchange for deals with Azerbaijan state energy firm SOCAR. This is Sultanov.
As I said, we have a lot of pipeline infrastructure. We have a lot of gas fields that are to be developed. We have a lot of green projects that SOCAR is very interested in. There are a lot of joint ventures that could be established, potential joint ventures. Our SOCAR trading is trading oil and gas all over the world, including in Asia. So to me, these are the possibilities to explore.
So while it's so critical, again, that was Sultanov thinking he was talking to a fossil fuel exec. In fact, it was someone from Global Witness. But you have at this COP, you could consider them a delegation, the largest delegation here, and that's of fossil fuel lobbyists. And you have this chief executive making fuel and oil deals while he's here. So why do you think you can have an effect as you talk about the imbalance of power, Assad?
Well, those very same lobbyists are, of course, affecting our decisions of government at national level as they are at global level. They're, of course, want to turn this climate negotiations into a trade fair. They're coming here to try and strike deals, make bargains, and, of course, propose their solutions. You see this lobbyist here calling for carbon capture and storage, unproven, deadly and dangerous technologies as solutions to the climate crisis. It's up to us to be imposing them, to put forward real solutions, to be supporting governments who do want to do the right thing and say, we're going to amplify your voice, we're going to support you, we're going to raise these issues, and we're going to build our movements, power, and make sure we're making the right call.
So the theme is financing. I was just talking to a Kenyan journalist who said Africa is faring very badly here. You're not wearing the regular COP lanyard. You're wearing one that says pay up.
Global civil society came together and we looked at what the true costs of supporting developing countries to be able to grow cleanly, what the cost of adapting to the climate crisis was, how much the damages were already overwhelming countries in the global south. And we calculated that is about $5 trillion a year that the global north would need to provide to the global south. That's just a down payment in the overall cost. And so we came here and said, look, the only way we're going to be able to transition fairly, cleanly, the only way that people in the global south will have the same right to live with dignified lives as people in the global north, if we have finance and technology being provided. We made the call for $5 trillion. Developing countries came here and said, at a base level, the lowest number, we must have $1.4 trillion a year. Rich developed countries are putting pennies on the table. They're not even talking about billions. They're talking the private sector will provide this finance. Open your economies to big corporations. They will be the answer. And we know they deliver nothing in terms of climate action. And of course, their only goal is to make profit.
Assad Raymond, I want to thank you for being with us. Executive Director of War on Want, lead spokesperson for the Climate Justice Coalition. As climate talks are underway here in Baku, human rights groups have warned of Azerbaijan's escalating crackdown on civil society groups, government critics, and the press. Since Azerbaijan was announced as the host of COP29 last year, more than a dozen activists and journalists have been arrested or arbitrarily detained, including prominent human rights and climate advocate Anar Mamadli, who is leader of Azerbaijan's largest independent election watchdog, an Azerbaijani anti-corruption advocate, Gubad Avadoglu, who is also a vocal critic of the oil and gas industry. For more, we're going nearby to Tbilisi, Georgia, where we're joined by Georgi Gogia, Associate Director of the Europe and Central Asia Division at Human Rights Watch, co-author of the recent report titled, We Try to Stay Invisible, Azerbaijan's escalating crackdown on critics and civil society. Georgi, welcome to Democracy Now! If you can start off by talking about the main findings of your report.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Amy. I just want to start with a very sad observation. I was listening to your program and watching how you interviewed, activists globally talking about the climate crisis, and I could not help but think about the deafening silence of Azerbaijani climate activists, human rights defenders, and think about what this COP would have been like if people on whose cases we documented in the report and on whose behalf I will be talking to you about, how different it would have been if they were there to voice their criticism, for their voices to be heard by the globe. Let me talk a little bit about the kind of findings. And Azerbaijan has had an abysmal rights record for many years, but it has dramatically deteriorated in the run-up to COP29. Human Rights Watch and Freedom Now have documented 33 cases of arrests, new arrests and imprisonments of journalists, activists, human rights defenders, and just government critics on various bogus charges. We have also found that government has used a very repressive laws to refuse the registration of independent groups and to push them to the margins of the law, allowing retaliatory prosecutions, which we have documented in this report.
So give us the example of people who have been arrested.
You have mentioned the name of Anar Mammadli, and he's the head of one of the top human rights groups. He's a veteran human rights defender, election monitoring watchdog, who has been arrested in April this year, shortly weeks after he announced the establishment of creation of climate of justice initiative intended to highlight the human rights problems of Azerbaijan in the run-up to COP29. And shortly after he published his independent observation report about the presidential elections from February this year. This is not the first time Arnar was arrested. He was arrested and served 2.5 years in 2013-14 when Azerbaijan was in the height of the crackdown against independent voices in the country. And the European Court of Human Rights has found not only the violation of the European Court in his arrest, but also that this violation, Azerbaijan pursued the ulterior motives in arresting him, intending to silence him. Unfortunately, once again, the Azerbaijani government is attempting to silence him after his registration of his one NGO was abolished and he was refused to register the second group that was working to monitor the elections in the country. He's facing multiple years, up to 8 or 12 years in prison on bogus charges of money smuggling. Another activist, professor, renowned scholar, anti-corruption activist who worked in the oil and gas field and criticized the lack of transparency of revenue in the oil and gas field in Azerbaijan is Gubadi Badoglu, a renowned scholar who was arrested last year and served 9 months in pretrial detention and is currently under limited house arrest, but still facing up to 17 years in jail if convicted on counterfeit and extremism charges. These are the voices you should be hearing during COP29 Baku, but you are not. I would also highlight the cases of independent journalists from several independent media, online media outlets, Abzas Media, Toplum TV, Human Rights Watch has documented 12 cases of journalists and 6 other media affiliated people with this media being arrested also in the last few months and facing money smuggling charges, tax evasion, and other bogus charges. These are, Ulvi, Hasanli, Sevinç, Vagif Gizi, Hafiz Babali, and others. And these are the people whose voices are again being silenced. These are the people who should be holding Azerbaijan, the powers, accountable to the people.
So if you can talk about if these issues are being raised here at the COP, I mean, you have top leaders of, for example, the West, European countries, Western countries. Are they pressuring Azerbaijan to release the journalists, the climate, the human rights activists who've been arrested in these last months in the lead up to this very summit?
Well, I certainly hope so, because this has been a call from local and international human rights groups, including some governments, that they should be engaging Baku, they should be engaging Azerbaijani authorities to ensure that everyone that is on politically motivated charges in prison in Azerbaijan are released and there's an end to the crackdown that's only intention is to silence the critical voices in the country. They should also be calling on Azerbaijani government to end the to amend the laws, the repressive laws that allow arbitrary implementation of those laws and allow the denial of the independent groups to register and be able to conduct independent legitimate human rights work in the country. You discussed how this is the great climate crisis, and this kind of climate crisis requires robust human rights actions by all governments, and but also this kind of response to this climate crisis requires the participation by all groups, independent groups in them. Unfortunately, the groups that we are not hearing during this call are Azerbaijani independent civil society that are languishing in jail or are in the house arrest or are in exile because they're not able to be present in Baku, to be present and doing negotiations, to be actively kind of promoting robust climate action. And this is not just kind of arrests, but there has been just last year, there has been other examples when climate activists, not even climate activists, like local residents of small village, for example, in Western Azerbaijan, in Soyodlu, have tried to organize, criticize the government for construction of the gold mine and the dam. And the government response has been such a heavy-handed by not only arresting and prosecuting the local population, but also cordoning, blocking the entire village for months, not allowing any journalists, confiscating their equipment and not allowing any information to get in or get out. So this is the country that that puts independent voices on the path of extinction. And it's really important that for Azerbaijan to end this crackdown, or for Azerbaijan's international partners to ensure, to insist, to urge Baku to release those unjustly imprisoned and end the crackdown in the country against critical voices.
Finally, and we just have 30 seconds for a response to this, the significance of oil and gas accounting for something like 92% of Azerbaijan's exports. Its main importer of that gas, 80% of it goes, the biggest importer is the European Union. Do you think that would stop them from criticizing the president and Azerbaijan overall?
Well, that certainly should not stop them from doing it. And you should be insisting that as part of the partnership, as part of the negotiations, as part of the cooperation between Azerbaijan and the European Union, Azerbaijan should adhere to the human rights, the principles of human rights. And I hope European Union is insisting on in direct calls or behind the closed doors, is insisting on the release of independent journalists, activists, human rights defenders, and the end to this crackdown. This is the only proper, the right response that the EU should be engaging in.
And Gugyorgy, finally, how common is it for you to do something like this today? Speak with a journalist on television inside Azerbaijan. Of course, you're outside.
Well, the reason I'm outside is because I have been detained and kicked out of the country in 2015, actually, when I was there to monitor the human, the trial of human rights defender. I was not allowed to get in. Furthermore, Human Rights Watch deputy director of the European Central Asia Division that had the registration for the COP 29 was rejected the visa just a few days ago and is not able to be on the ground to highlight it. So the reason I am speaking from afar is because Azerbaijan is preventing many of us who criticize Azerbaijan from entering the country. It is closing for international scrutiny its borders. Nevertheless, we continue to do the work and highlight the cases of those who are in prison on nothing more but doing their legitimate human rights work.
Georgi Gogia, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Associate Director of the Europe and Central Asia Division at Human Rights Watch, co-author of the report, which we will link to, We Try to Stay Invisible, Azerbaijan's Escalating Crackdown on Critics and Civil Society, speaking to us from Tbilisi, Georgia. When we come back, President-elect Trump has promised to pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement again. And while filling out his cabinet, he's chosen oil and gas industry executive Chris Wright as his nominee for energy secretary, a fracking magnate, a climate denier, a champion of fossil fuels. We'll be back in 20 seconds. Without Us by the Reverend Billy and the Stop Shopping Choir. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. As we continue our coverage from COP29 here in Baku, Azerbaijan, I'm Amy Goodman. We look at what Donald Trump's re-election as U.S. president means for the climate. Clean energy and environmental advocates are raising alarm over Trump's nomination of oil and gas industry executive Chris Wright to serve as energy secretary. Wright's a fracking magnate who's long championed fossil fuel production and publicly denied the existence of the climate crisis. He's the CEO of the Denver-based oil field firm Liberty Energy, serves on the board of Oklo, a nuclear power startup. Wright posted this video on his LinkedIn profile just last year.
There is no climate crisis, and we're not in the midst of an energy transition either. Humans and all complex life on Earth is simply impossible without carbon dioxide. Hence, the term carbon pollution is outrageous. There is no such thing as clean energy or dirty energy. These five terms, climate crisis, energy transition, carbon pollution, clean energy, and dirty energy, are not only deceptive, they are, in fact, destructive deceptions.
Wright is also known for drinking a fracking fluid bleach cocktail on camera to prove it was safe. In a statement, Trump said Wright would be ushering in a so-called golden age of American prosperity and global peace, unquote. Trump's also announced North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum as his pick to lead the Interior Department, a position currently held by Deb Haaland, who made history as the first Native American to ever serve as cabinet secretary. Trump wrote in a statement, quote, "We will drill, baby, drill, expand all forms of energy production to grow our economy and create good-paying jobs," unquote. Burgum was also tapped to head a newly created National Energy Council, which will seek to, quote, enforce U.S. energy dominance, unquote, globally. For more, we're joined here in Baku by Manish Bapna, president of the NRDC, that's the Natural Resources Defense Council, and Natural Resources Defense Council Action. So we just have a few minutes at the end of this show. First, respond to Chris Wright's nomination, the climate denier, the fracking magnate, the man who drank bleach and fracking fluid on TV.
It is deeply troubling. It is startling, but shouldn't be a surprise. in light of the fact of who nominated him. It's particularly jarring as we sit here in Baku at the climate COP. We're already flirting with 1.5 degrees. We have already kind of behind the game in reducing emissions. And now we have not only Chris Wright, but we have Doug Burgum as the head of Interior, potentially, and Lee Zeldin as the head of the Environmental Protection Agency. These are serious positions. They're senior cabinet positions in the next administration for the United States, charged with protecting clean air, clean water, creating jobs for the future. And all of these nominations are just deeply troubling. They represent significant regression at a time when we need to see much, much greater progress.
So what are you doing about it? We said nominate. We didn't say they are appointed,
exactly.
Although that's what President-elect Trump would like to see, is recess appointments. So how are you organizing?
We are trying to shine a light on who they are and what they represent and how out of touch they are with what the public actually wants. When we see polling around the importance of clean air, clean water, protecting public health, creating jobs, lowering energy costs, the thing is that clean energy has been demonstrated to be more affordable, more reliable. It's more energy secure than a lot of the other options that people are promoting. We even see with the unprecedented progress that's happened in the last few years with the Inflation Reduction Act, an incredible set of investments taking place all around the country. The Inflation Reduction Act has generated 85% of investments in red districts, in Republican districts. 68% of the jobs created are in Republican districts. We are demonstrating that clean energy is good for the entire country, and they're going to take us backwards. And so we're going to do what we can to shine a light on their record and try to see if we could find the right people to lead these agencies. But if that is not possible, we will do what we can to hold them accountable.
So having Energy Secretary Chris Wright, not only does President Trump, President-elect Trump at this point, want recess appointments, he doesn't want them backgrounded by the FBI. When you don't have a hearing, you don't learn about people's financial investments, conflicts of interest. Trump himself has refused to sign ethics forms since October. What would that mean, a man who would stand to gain an enormous amount as head of energy company, Liberty Energy?
All you have to do is follow the money, right? All three of these candidates, you look at someone like Chris Wright, who we heard what he said, and we know where he would actually benefit. He is the CEO of a fracking company. We have Doug Burgum, who played an important role in brokering a deal between President-elect Trump and oil and gas billionaires in Florida a couple months ago when President-elect Trump said that for $1 billion, he will provide favors to the oil and gas industry. We have to follow the money. And that is one of the biggest challenges we see in politics in the United States today, which has been exacerbated since Citizens United back in 2010. More money into politics, more corporate money into politics, has just created the challenges we're seeing today.
Talk more about North Dakota, Governor Burgum. Of course, North Dakota, the site of an epic battle in the last years around the Dakota Access Pipeline with Energy Transfer Partners. But what it means to have him as head of the Interior, and not only head of the Interior, Donald Trump has said he will also serve as energy czar.
This is a huge job, right? The Department of the Interior is responsible for our public lands, about conservation, about how we use those public lands wisely for today and for tomorrow. And so he'll be in a position to expand oil and gas leasing in offshore water, on land, at a time when just last year's COP, as you mentioned earlier, the international community recognized we needed to transition away from fossil fuels. The United States is already the largest oil and gas producer in the world, increasing rapidly. And now we have someone who has promised to further accelerate oil and gas exploration in the United States. Perhaps most notably, will be lifting the pause on LNG exports that the Biden administration put in place just 6 months ago. And with someone like him responsible for energy across the entire administration, it creates real serious concerns about how we make sure that the United States stays focused on the clean energy transition. The one thing I would say, though,
we have 10 seconds,
is that the clean energy transition in the United States is unstoppable. It's going to hit some speed bumps now, but it will move forward.
Manish Bapna, president of the Natural Resources Defense Council, Natural Resources Defense Council Action. That does it for our show. Our deepest condolences to Karen Ranucci on the passing of her father, and a happy 80th birthday to Danny DeVito. I'm Amy Goodman here in Baku, Azerbaijan.
The Museum of Lenox in Addington invites you to join them over the holidays celebrating Friday Night Lights on Friday, November 29th, December 6th, and December 13th. Stop by the museum between 5 to 8 p.m. each night for a free visit, live music, open galleries, festive crafts with local artists in the Creation Corner, shopping in the museum gift shop, and a special museum kids holiday shop where kids can shop for $2 gifts and have their presents wrapped. Plus, attendees can also enjoy an immersive seasonal candlelit play, House Guest, created by and starring Kingston-based emerging actors and dance school of drama and music university students. Advanced tickets are $10. Details at countymuseum.ca. CFRC 101.9